Welcome to The Authority File, the Academic Library podcast from Choice. Choice is a publishing division of the ACRL and the publisher of Choice Reviews and CC Advisor. This episode is brought to you by Human Relations Area Files, or HRAF. I'm Bill Mickey, the host of the podcast and the editorial director at Choice, and for this four-episode series, my guest and I discuss the origin of the Human Relations Area Files as an independent cross-cultural research agency based at Yale and as a publisher of the uniquely developed eHRAF World Cultures and Archaeology databases. We'll also describe some of the new research our guests are currently developing in their respective fields. So, for the next few episodes, I'll be joined by Dr. Carol Ember, president of HRAF and lead investigator on a five-year NSF-supported interdisciplinary research project to study how natural hazards may have transformed cultures. Also joining us is Dr. Peter Peregrin, HRAF's chairman of the board and Lawrence University professor of anthropology. In this second episode of our series, our guests and I talk more about the content in eHRAF and its interdisciplinary potential. Okay, so when we last spoke, Dr. Peregrin, you noted that the search function in eHRAF may seem counterintuitive to folks who are perhaps used to keyword searching, not index search. Can you explain why that is?
Sure. It is a little bit counterintuitive until you get used to the subject searching versus keyword searching. But it's extremely powerful, I think. And we can use an example of crime. If one's interested in crime, what you would do in eHRAF is you would go into the outline of cultural materials and find the subject for crime. And then you would search using that subject, and it would bring up all of the information about crime in all of the files of the cultures that you're looking for. If you were to use a simple keyword and put in something like crime or assault or homicide or something, you would get a set of results that would end up not necessarily covering all of that material that you wanted. It may be that the ethnographer was talking about homicide, but never called it a crime. And so that would not appear if you were doing a keyword search on crime. Mm-hmm. On the other side, if the ethnographer called something crime and you were looking for homicide, it wouldn't come up either. And so the subject searching can be really powerful because you know that you're going to get all of the information about the concept or the subject you're interested in. Whereas with a keyword search, you may come up with only part of the information that subject covers.
I want to add one other thing that's really important about keyword searching and why it's problematic. It's almost always true that keywords only bring up the marked instance of something actually happening. So, for example, when people are fighting wars, if you search for the word war, you might find examples of war, but you're never going to find the examples of when people aren't, because the word won't appear. So what you need to do in a good research study is to try to find the general subjects where you can be pretty sure an ethnographer will say something about, let's say, crime appearing or not appearing, but they won't actually. If you just search for the word, you're almost always finding only those cases that do it. You're not finding the cases that don't.
Okay. Peter, let's go back to you for just a sec. Sure. Wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the ethnographies in eHRAF. I think Carol mentioned them a little bit earlier. Can you just dig in a little bit more into what they are and where they come from, and how perhaps HRAF is commissioning new work and where that's coming from?
Sure. The ethnographies, let me go back to something that I mentioned in talking about searching, and that is that by spending the time to categorize each paragraph by its subject or subjects, it provides a very powerful and accurate way of acquiring information about a subject of interest. And the same is true about the ethnographies and how they're chosen. The ethnographies that have been included in HRAF are those that are most high quality. Those are ones that are recognized in the field as being solid ethnographies by well-qualified ethnographers. And in fact, there's information in the files about the ethnographer, the time frame, the amount of time that they spent with the culture, all of that kind of information. So you get not only an assurance of quality, but you can also assess the quality of the information that ethnographer has provided. So one of the things that HRAF provides is an assurance of quality, not only the quality of obtaining subject material, but also quality of where the data are coming from. Mm-hmm. The HRAF has commissioned some material over the years. Carol can probably address that better. To my knowledge, nothing has been commissioned recently. As for HRAF archaeology, the same sort of thing is true as for ethnography, in that the materials that are included are resources that are recognized of high quality.
Okay.
So we mostly actually do not commission new work. I think there are very few occasions where we feel we really need some information from somebody who hasn't already written something about their fieldwork. But most of the time, we prefer to use works that have been vetted, either by peer review or by publishing houses. So we mostly only commission the culture summaries, which are standardized templates for about 10 to 12 pages in length for each of our cultures or traditions. Actually, most of those were actually commissioned earlier for the various encyclopedias HRAF did, the Encyclopedia of World Cultures and then the Encyclopedia of Prehistory, which Peter edited. So it's mostly not commissioned new work.
Okay. And then let's, we spoke earlier about sort of the interdisciplinary approach to the development of HRAF. So I imagine that that's even more true in terms of who can use the resource. And I'm wondering if you could just kind of help us understand that potential by, maybe telling us a story or two about some of the more interesting uses you've seen coming from specific research areas in terms of, maybe non-traditional disciplines using HRAF as a resource.
So one of the most interesting things that I've come across, which comes from a very different field, we found in the British Journal of Cancer, which actually used resources in HRAF to try to get a handle on how a virus that's associated with AIDS may be transmitted. It was specifically about the human herpes virus 8, which is associated with Kaposi's sarcoma. And the researchers noted that this must have some non-sexual mode of transmission, since in some areas of the world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, there's a pretty high incidence of this sarcoma in children. So the researcher got the idea to look at cultural practices that might involve saliva and whether there are ways that people are transmitting it, particularly from an adult to a child. And I found it fascinating that the researcher looked for sub-Saharan African cultures and did in this case some word searches for saliva and spit, and I forgot a few other choices of keywords. And they found three domains of cultural practice that could be clues to a non-sexual mode of transmission. And one of them which was actually quite common, was the use of saliva, often mixed with herbs, for first aid to put in open wounds. This was actually fairly common. And, you know, most Americans would probably go, ooh, why would you do that? But it's possible that if it weren't for these herpes viruses, that saliva might have been working to fix wounds. There's a lot of things that people do that, you know, pre-science, that actually turn out to be very powerful medicines, such as aspirin was discovered from outside. It was completely outside medicinal, Western medicinal practice.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing they found with saliva use was in some rituals, like one initiation ceremony for girls. The girls would pass beads or twigs held in their mouths, pass them from one girl to another. Actually, it reminds me of a game we played as a kid for Halloween, where you had a bob for apples and then pass the apple from one person to another. But the third main use of saliva, which could be passed to infants, was that in many cultures, mothers have to pre-chew food so babies can eat it. These are people who didn't have baby food that come in jars. And for a lot of food, babies are simply not able to, they don't have the teeth to digest things. So commonly mothers pre-chew food and give them to their infants. So this I thought was fascinating because, you know, we didn't know who this person was. This research actually just appeared. And the researcher pointed out that you'd have to check with more recent time periods when we do have information about AIDS and these herpes viruses, whether they were still being practiced. But here's an example where older stuff might be more useful than new stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Because in recent times, a lot of people know that Westerners think their medical practices are kind of weird or disgusting, and they won't tell you. If you ask them, hey, do you put saliva on your wounds, they might say no, because they know we're going to think it's bad or strange. So very often the earlier material, which is when these practices were actually happening probably more in the open, could give you better information, at least as a starting point, than more recent information. The other study I wanted to tell you about was actually something that I did, and with my late husband, with a political scientist, which kind of shows you the interdisciplinary use of ethnography. So it's widely claimed in studies of international relations that democracies do not fight each other. But it's also, and it's a very robust finding, but it's also the case that democratic countries also have different qualities from other countries, such as they tend to be richer, the democracies tend to be in formal alliances such as NATO. And so the question arises, is this a real generalization about polities, or is it simply something that's an artifact of we're just looking at countries? So we decided, together with Bruce Russett, who's a political scientist, to try to test this hypothesis in a very different domain. Actually, we did it before there was an ERAF. It was the paper collection of the ERAF collection of ethnography. But we decided to look at the anthropological cultures to see if there's any merit to this idea that democracies don't fight each other. It's a little complicated, but in order to do this research, we had to transform the hypothesis because most anthropological cultures do not have any political centralization at all. Sometimes the community is the largest polity. Most of them don't have equivalent of elections. So we had to come up with other measures of democracy, but we more aptly call it degree to which adults participate in local decision making, whether they can remove a leader that they don't like, those kind of measures, which we did for the ethnographic materials. And we also realized that in uncentralized societies, and the international arena is not between one society and another, but it's between often one community and another. So we transformed the hypothesis to look at, do societies with more political participation at the local level, do they fight less with other communities nearby? And we were pretty amazed because we had to do a lot of transformation here, but we actually found pretty robust support for this hypothesis that there was less fighting within the society in cultures that had much more political participation. So this gives us confidence that the proposition may be correct. And this study was actually fairly widely cited by political scientists who realized that being able to take the theory to another domain was actually very useful.
You just heard from Dr. Carol Ember and Dr. Peter Peregrin. This concludes the second of our four-part series on the origin of the Human Relations Area Files as an independent cross-cultural research agency based at Yale and as publisher of the eHRAF World Cultures and Archaeology Databases. This episode was brought to you by HRAF. Be sure to join us for the next episode where our guests reveal next steps for the eHRAF platform of products, including upcoming data mining applications, open access initiatives, and new market potential.
I'll give you an example of a little pilot project we recently worked with, the Harvard Song Project. They're studying songs around the world to help them do some data mining in eHRAF. They were interested in identifying the types of music, of subject matter that were associated with music. So they were able to take all the paragraphs about music and data mine those paragraphs for what kinds of words and concepts were associated with those paragraphs to help them see what people were doing with music.
Find all the episodes of The Authority File on your favorite podcast app or on our website, choice360.org. Just click on the librarianship dropdown. On choice360.org, you'll also find information on Choice's entire product platform, including Choice Reviews, CC Advisor, Choice Webinars, resources for college libraries, our white papers, and a whole lot more. A great way to keep up with The Authority File is to join the Choice Authority File Facebook group, which you can access via the Choice Reviews Facebook page. As a member of the group, you can give us feedback, suggest podcast participants, chat with other listeners, and submit new topic ideas. That's all for this week. Thanks for joining us.